Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jessica Yates for Huffman Livestock, and I would like to reserve around 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the trial court started off with the wrong framework by focusing effectively on a misrepresentation framework and a duty to disclose. And there was a misrepresentation claim that's not even being appealed today. Instead, the core of the case revolved around conversion, unjust enrichment, civil theft, and those claims were around the UCC analysis. And that's where the trial court erred by applying the wrong framework for that analysis. Instead, that analysis is much broader than is there a duty to disclose. It's about what it means to be a good faith purchaser under the UCC. And that was defendant's burden, specifically Mr. Mount's burden to carry at trial. And what that means is, do you meet both an objective and a subjective test? In the first part of that analysis, were reasonable commercial standards followed in this case? The trial court never went down that road.
Ask you this, counsel. With regard to honesty in fact, and then the observance of reasonable commercial standards, fair dealing, is there a requirement that the defendant meet both?
Yes, Your Honor, there is that requirement. The word and is conjunctive. And if UCC history shows that that is intentional. In fact, Colorado adopted that observance of commercial standards in 2006, before it was just the subjective standard. And that was intentional, to add an additional requirement. And what's actually notable is that with merchants, it even applied before that time, but it's always been construed as meeting both requirements.
So if we were to agree with you for discussion purposes, that one of them was not met, say the commercial standards, would we even need to reach the other one?
Your Honor, I don't believe you do need to reach the other one for that very reason, that because the commercial standards were not met in this case. And the reason that we don't believe commercial standards were met, you can look at it in a small framework or larger framework, but basically you look at whether Mount was following commercial standards vis-a-vis Smith. And Smith was giving away $150 per head, just giving it away to Mount. And there was no contention at trial that there was an industry standard that provided for that. In fact, the evidence at trial from both the plaintiffs and defendants was that the borrower's responsibility was to pay that equity. And so for Smith to take that on behalf of Mount simply didn't make any sense.
What do we do with the trial court's finding of fact that the cattle industry has its own standard, and that standard is a loose standard, a handshake, that type of thing?
Well, Your Honor, I would contend that that's not entirely accurate, because if the Submini case actually suggests that it is a higher standard than that, and that's that Colorado Supreme Court case. And the Submini case said, well, they're a little loose, but here the buyer and seller had 2 years' worth of good dealings, and because of that, we're going to say the standard was met.
So are we bound by the standard that the Supreme Court found in Submini then?
I think that's an accurate standard. I would respectfully contend the trial court was incorrect in suggesting that it was this impossibly loose standard, because the standard wasn't Mount and Huffman's dealing. And again, that's where the trial court got off on the wrong track. That's an interesting question for a misrepresentation claim. But the standard we need to be looking at is the Mount Smith standard. Is it reasonable to just take $150 per head off someone else's cattle? There's no industry standard that says that's reasonable. So it goes beyond handshake deals and should have you checked someone out. Mount didn't have to check out Smith, because all of this was pursuant to this big payoff agreement. He knew Smith up and down. He had gone into many different failed business dealings with him. So again, the standard is, was Mount a good faith purchaser as to Smith? And if you look at that transaction, he simply can't meet that standard, just starting off at the objective standard of reasonable commercial dealings. And Your Honor, in terms of the subjective standard, I'll just briefly say that We don't think that's met here either, because the case law is clear, both in Colorado and in other jurisdictions, that to meet that standard, it's not just about your actual knowledge. You don't need it if there are reasonable or obvious circumstances or obvious or suspicious circumstances that should prompt you to wonder what's going on. And here, the whole series of events, Smith can't pay, and that's why he's going into this whole payoff arrangement. He can't pay, and then all of a sudden, instead of moving his own cattle, he wants to buy replacement cattle. And I look to that Black Hawk Pontiac case that is really on point to this, where that car dealer, he couldn't pay. He said, well, I'll float some cars. Well, instead of floating the cars, he goes down the street and just buys them from someone else that he's not going to pay. So it's really on point. And that case also is instructive because there the defendants also tried to blame the innocent seller. You shouldn't have gotten an out-of-state check. That was your own fault for accepting an out-of-state check. The Court of Appeals in that case disregarded that fact. That wasn't relevant to whether the ultimate purchaser was a good faith purchaser as to its seller. And so I would recommend that case to this court. So, Your Honors, that's good faith purchaser analysis, and it applies, of course, to the buyer in ordinary course analysis as well, because if you're not a good faith purchaser, you can't be a buyer in the ordinary course. The buyer in ordinary course also has a conjunctive requirement that you also have to be buying in the ordinary course, and that's where the antecedent debt issue comes in. And here we know that there was antecedent debt, that at least a portion of this was antecedent debt, and a portion of this had no value because to in terms of what Mount gave Smith, because it was free money at that $150 per head. But I would point out that there's other ways you can be or fail to be a buyer in the ordinary course, and those are present in this unique case, given everything that Mount knew, given that this was all for pre-existing debt as to Smith, and it was all for him to sort of try to get rid of these bad debts that he had incurred vis-a-vis both Mount and cattle consultants. Now, I'd like to spend just a moment on cattle consultants. As you know from the briefs...
Before you move on to cattle consultants, sure. It seems to me in reading the briefs and the case law that was cited that we wouldn't have much of an issue if the parties had complied with the livestock bill of sale laws or with 42403.1.5, which deals specifically with livestock. Mm-hmm. Do you agree that the parties did not comply with those laws in this case?
Your Honor, we do concede that.
Doesn't that sort of lend itself to this loose standard out there in the industry when the legislature has attempted repeatedly to come up with some laws, and it appears that within the industry, they continue to do business the old-fashioned way?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that characterization based on the Subnini case. Again, in that case, they observed the same type of problem. The parties didn't comply with the bill of sale laws. And that wasn't what prompted the court to say, well, you know, there are loose standards. That was one of many factors that, yes, you can do these transactions without complying with the laws, and they'll go through. But what really the case turned on was the fact that that purchaser, who was trying to be a good faith purchaser in that case, had no idea that its seller was in financial trouble. He had dealt with them for 2 years with successful trading. And so what the court did there is said, okay, well, so you didn't comply with the law, but under the good faith purchaser standard, that is something that we're going to look at, and you're a good faith purchaser because of your history. And, Your Honor, I would point you to a case law, I think it's cited in the brief, that when you look at somebody, a good faith purchaser in the trade, that is meant to raise the bar, not to lower it. And the cases consistently hold that you're supposed to be sophisticated enough to know what's going on. And Mr. Mount here was sophisticated enough because he had dealt with Freddie Smith for a long time over many transactions. Just really briefly with cattle consultants, as you know from the briefs, the most straightforward way of resolving it is that under 9203, their security interest does not attach. First, because Mount didn't have any rights in the collateral, so he couldn't pledge that collateral, but also because Cattle Consultants didn't give value. That's an additional requirement, and it was undisputed at trial that they were just switching a bad, uncollectible debt for a good debt, and that there really was no value given. There is the additional way to look at that, which Colorado hasn't really taken this approach thus far, but there are other jurisdictions that do, and that is to say, was Cattle Consultants a good faith purchaser under the UCC? And for reasons that I think we've gone through, they're also not a good faith purchaser. And that is observance of reasonable commercial standards. Well, you know, not really. They went into a payoff agreement with Mount to try to offload some of its bad debt. And knowing that Smith hadn't been able to pay anyone so far, they agreed to him using quote-unquote replacement cattle. And the red flags were off in all directions. How in the world would he pay for this? And Mr. Hoff, the principal of Cattle Consultants, testified at trial that he didn't believe that Smith had any additional sources of financing, and he didn't know how he was going to pay for it. So that was really quite compelling as to the big picture that we're looking at here. So when you look at the cases that are cited by Cattle Consultants, for example, the Money Mart decision, you know, they cite to that case. Well, that case actually supports our position because it recites the standard of the subjective good faith standard. Were there any suspicious circumstances that should have aroused the attention? So again, it's not put your head in the sand and be willfully blind. Were there any reasonably suspicious circumstances? And here we have that because of the fact that he's all of a sudden using replacement cattle, and yet again refusing to move his own cattle to Colorado when everyone knew Smith had been lying about that, because he was supposed to move his cattle to Colorado, but instead he moved some of it to Texas. And everyone knew that he was lying about it.
Now, as I see, you're at about three.
Okay. I will reserve. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Brandon Houchins, Attorney Registration 31991. I represent Janie Mount and M5 Consulting. And an issue not mentioned by Ms. Yates is standard of review. And in reflecting back on my answer brief, I don't think I spent enough time or attention clarifying what our side believes is the appropriate standard for this court to apply in scrutinizing the trial court's order. While it is true that if the trial court applied an incorrect standard of law, this court should review it de novo, but as you look at the reply brief from Huffman, you'll see that most of the arguments are focused on ultimately findings of fact from the trial court. And the trial court made findings of fact both with regard to the objective and subjective tests under 42403. And in that regard, what this court ought to do with respect to a standard of review is apply a clear error standard of review. And Mount prevailed at the trial court, and the order should be affirmed at this court on two sides of 42403. One, Mount qualified as a good faith purchaser for value, satisfying both the honesty in fact and observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing requirements. He also qualifies under the entrustment provision as a buyer in the ordinary course of business, which itself contains the good faith subjective standard and the usual or customary practices in the kind of business standard. The trial court didn't look just to the Signini case to apply a standard within the industry as a matter of law. The trial court found that the standards in the industry as applied in this case were as they were described in the Signini case. In Huffman's reply brief, they characterize or paraphrase that as a bit relaxed. Just a moment ago, Ms. Yates used the phrase a little loose. the precise phrase from the trial court and referenced by both the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court in the Signini case was rather loose. Now, the trial court in our case used the same phrase from the Signini case, but didn't do so just as a matter of law. The trial court used that phrase after scrutinizing the evidence, and it was not the product of a clear error. The evidence at trial, which came both at a June 7th, 2010 Rule 104 hearing, and then again in February of last year at trial, came from Mr. Mount, with a long history in the cattle business, Joe Hoff on behalf of Cattle Consultants, who has an even longer history in the cattle business, and perhaps more importantly, from Perry Huffman, the principal of Huffman Livestock, about how the business is done, again, in the absence of adhering to the livestock bill of sale law, that there are certain ways of verifying the creditworthiness or trustworthiness of a buyer. And those standards were met here as described by Mr. Huffman himself and his wife, Tracy Huffman.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Why are the cattle customs relied upon by the district court? Why do they constitute? Let me start over again and try it this way. Now that we have the Uniform Commercial Code, and given the Uniform Commercial Code, which has been enacted by the legislature, given the standards from the Uniform Commercial Code, why are the cattle customs that were discussed by the trial court as being rather loose or loose, why do they trump the laws that have been enacted by our legislature under the Uniform Commercial Code?
It's an excellent question. I can't really speak to that. I suppose it would have been an interesting topic at trial, and evidence on that question might have been helpful for Judge Hobbs in determining what standard to apply. What's interesting about that, though, Your Honor, is that neither Huffman nor Mount nor Cattle Consultants presented any outside expert testimony to influence that issue. Now, the parties involved had their own expertise and their own history, and I can't speak to the industry beyond what I learned through the trial and what I read in the Signini cases, but it seems to me that despite legislatures' attempts to codify some rules that might make this whole industry more manageable, it doesn't seem that people follow those rules. Fortunately, in Colorado, and it's unique, there are a couple of states that have cited Signini as being instructive in various cases. I think Kansas is another state that's cited Signini. Fortunately for us, and I think for this court, we do have some Supreme Court authority that says exactly what to do when parties ignore the livestock bill of sale law and either adhere or don't adhere to the industry standards that are prevailing at the time. Here, Judge Hobbs paid close attention to the testimony of all the parties. And the very end of the Supreme Court Signini opinion, there's some discussion there about what is reasonable in relation to the industry standards. And the analysis included specific discussion about the parties themselves and how they interacted within the context of the transaction. And there wasn't a lot of analysis. It was very cursory at the end of the opinion. But if you apply that framework in this case, particularly with respect to the Huffman end, looking to Smith's lender, looking to the order buyer, Edgar Evans, looking to, most importantly, Smith's lender, Great Plains National Bank, as sources for information, you can see what's reasonable. What's reasonable isn't what does the stranger have to say in response to one question during one brief conversation. And I think that the trial court did a sufficient job in justifying its application of that analysis. And again, it's very much fact intensive, and it relies on the trial court's finding of fact, where the trial court found, A, you've got the subjective side, honesty in fact, which, as I've argued, is strictly subjective, and then B, the observance of reasonable commercial standards, which is objective.
So you agree both of those standards apply, subjective and objective?
They do, and I think why that's important from our perspective, Your Honor, is that the way I read Huffman's argument, Huffman is trying to argue that honesty in fact, in this case, means more than responding honestly to a question, and that it connotes or requires disclosure beyond that. The reason I don't believe that makes sense for this court is that there is the objective half of the test. So I think it was the Powderhorn case, and I'm sorry if I'm, it's been referenced in all the briefs, talks about how the honesty in fact test, and that was a case before the 2006 addition to the subject or the objective half, where the court says that's without regard to the party's negligence, which to me means it doesn't matter whether you are upholding a reasonable person standard as we normally look at in the negligence context. It's purely subjective. So we've got that for honesty in fact. For observance of reasonable commercial standards, we've got the objective test. So to challenge Mount's honesty in fact on the basis that he had a duty to disclose or that industry standards compelled him to do so is ignoring the requirements of the objective test, which is the second half of being a good faith purchaser for value. And I think that analysis applies again when we get to the buyer in the ordinary course of business, where we're using the entrustment provision of the statute. Another comment I'd like to make is this issue of consideration and the end portion of the definition of a buyer in the ordinary course regarding the disqualification of a buyer who acquires goods in total or partial satisfaction of a money debt. The trial court made findings of fact about the consideration provided. The trial court found specifically that there was about $70,000 in new consideration provided by Mr. Mount for these 165 cattle. Part of it was debt relief from Mr. Smith. The authority we have and have cited says, and I don't believe there's any contradictory authority, that by doing so, you are not prevented from being a buyer in the ordinary course because you are providing the new consideration. It isn't purely an exchange of these goods for cancellation of an antecedent debt. So here again, Huffman may quibble with what the trial court found with regard to this new consideration, but the trial court made a finding of fact, and I think if there's ample support in the record, this isn't, you don't have to dig for this, that Mr. Mount, by taking on Smith's cattle, provided $70,000 in new consideration. So he remains a buyer in the ordinary course. And I'm happy not to use all my time if your honors don't have any more questions for me.
You're here for cattle consultants?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can use your time that way if you'd like. It's up to you.
Yeah. About 4 minutes left for your argument if you want to argue for cattle consultants.
Okay, I'll just be real quick.
Okay.
I just want to address, I'm David Wyatt. My attorney registration number is 34223, and I represent Cattle Consultants, LLC. And briefly, I just wanted to address Cattle Consultants as a good faith purchaser. Ms. Yates for Huffman cited that there were circumstances that should have made them, I guess, inquire further, and hence, if they would have done so, would have blown up the deal because instead, they chose to be willfully blind, according to their briefs. I disagree with that. I think that the cases and the appellant cited the same case, Richards versus Platteville Valley Bank, sort of show that there needs to be some sort of dishonesty in fact. And that requires some intent to cause fraud or some other type of wrongful conduct. And there was none here. The only thing that could be considered negligent, which is debatable, is whether Cal Consultants investigated further into the finances of Mr. Smith. They did have, she claims that they never did have any, paid any debts or anything like that. Well, that's not true because Mr. Smith had been paying loans prior to that made with Cal Consultants. They were aware that he was making other payments. They did look at this trust that Mr. Smith had as significant amount of money that potentially he could rely on. So I don't think they had the duty to continue to investigate and inquire into that, which to me takes away any special circumstances that would cause them to do that.
So let me ask you this. Is Cal Consultants attached at the hip to Mount to the extent that if we conclude that Mount is not a buyer in the ordinary course, then does that necessarily mean that Cal Consultants does not have a perfected interest?
Well, I think it would just by the chain of events. There's no way under the statutes, the Smith had to have collateral to secure and had to have rights in that collateral. So, and unless Mont had to have that. So unless Mont had that, then obviously he had no, Cal Consultants had no rights to that collateral. So I would agree with that statement. And finally, just under your value added, the statute just says, and it's, I think, a real it's enough consideration that you could form a contract. And, we know how low consideration can be in forming contracts. You just given when you cite a deed for $1 million property, you cite $10 and other such consideration. Consideration, the amount of it isn't so determinative of whether or not there was consideration or not. And there obviously was consideration with the added value with the $75,000. Obviously, Cal Consultants moved debts that they didn't have to do under any other circumstances. So at basically not acting on rights that they originally had is consideration. So I think that its consideration part is adequate enough to support the value added in the statute. Any other questions?
Yates, you have about 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just would like to respond to some of Mr. Houchin's arguments around looking at Huffman's End and was he complying with industry standards. And just want to reiterate, Mr. Mount wouldn't be a good faith purchaser even if he had never had a conversation with Perry Huffman. That's not what the UCC analysis turns on at all. It's an interesting fact, and it suggests he was trying to hide something, but that's not the point. That was relevant to the misrepresentation claim, but again, that's not before this court on appeal. So this isn't about a duty to disclose. That's not what we're arguing, that Mount should have told Huffman more than he did. What we're looking at is under cases like the Black Hawk Pontiac and the brief cite plenty more cases where either a buyer was heavily involved in the seller's affairs and knew that they were having financial problems, or were setting up some deals for debt repayment when it was pretty obvious that they weren't going to be able to really repay the debt, accepting things at abnormally low prices under circumstances that should be raising red flags. These are the kinds of things that defeat a good faith purchaser or buyer in the ordinary course status. And that's the focus of our appeal. So with that, I do want to respond to one of Judge Roman's questions, do Cal Customs trump the law? And what should we know about industry standards? And some of this I know is in the briefs, but a Kansas case, Hammer v. Thompson, talks about that you don't need expert testimony to establish industry standards. And if you look to the cases that we cite, none of them are trying to figure out a special industry standard that applies. But it's pretty clear when the behavior starts to look a little underhanded, or that you're looking self-dealing, looking out for yourself, trying to take more than you can, you don't have to define the industry standard and see whether it would comport with that, because it's just not reasonable commercial standards. And that really is the baseline. Industry standards are supposed to raise the bar, not lower the bar. And was it reasonable commercial standards the way this transaction happened? Absolutely not. I do want to just point out as well that the cases we cite, including Richards and some of these other cases for the subjective component, they don't require a showing of dishonesty. What they do require is that there are suspicious circumstances that you may be turning your head to, just to correct one aspect of that. Your Honors, do you have any questions before I run out of time? Thank you very much for your time.
It's not. Thank you. Counsel, thank you for your arguments, and the matter will stand submitted before the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.